The Guardian.
Hi everyone, Alex Hearn here. Tim Wu is a law professor at Columbia University, best known for coining the term net neutrality and for tracing the history of modern communications in his last book, The Master Switch. In his new book, The Attention Merchants, he's looking at advertising, propaganda and the media, and how the early utopian potential of the internet has given way to naked capitalism. So Tim, tell us about some of the early ways our attention was first captured and then resold.
You know, it hasn't always been the case that attention was understood to be valuable. I think if you were talking 200 years ago, government didn't really care about the public very much. Businesses didn't advertise 200 years ago. It was only really when newspapers began to understand that there was a business model in rounding up a crowd and reselling their attention that you first had the harvesting of attention in any sense. And I think the origins, as far as I can tell, of the first ad-supported newspapers were in New York City in the 1830s. And really tabloid papers. They had, you know, guts and crime and violence and very sort of exciting things to get people to read them. Stories about life on the moon. And that's the origins of it, really the tabloid model, which then, you know, bit by bit has essentially taken over not only most of the media landscape, but frankly, most of our waking lives. So that's the story, yeah.
A large portion of your book is the lessons we can draw for the present day from the way those early newspapers succeeded in capturing the attention of everyone. What are those lessons?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, going back to the first sort of tabloid newspapers, 1830s, they were successful. I'm thinking of the New York Sun. As I said, reporting on crime, murder, mayhem, but it soon became very competitive. And within the first, say, 3 or 4 years of competition, you learn everything. First of all, that the competition for attention is usually a race to the bottom. If you want to get people interested in stuff, it's never too lurid, too outrageous. I mean, just look at the current president of the United States to get a sense of how do you gain attention. Scandal, violence, those kind of things work. So that's lesson number one. The second lesson that they used was that insults or attacks are incredibly effective at getting people interested. Fights. Right away, the early newspapers began attacking each other, attacking other people. And finally, within the first early invention, you had the invention of fake news. And it's kind of amazing. They, as I said, reported on life on the moon. They reported on these miracle cures where people would live forever, all kinds of strange stuff. Because frankly, making things up is often more interesting than publishing real news. You know, as a reporter, you probably noticed that. If you could embellish your stories, it would be a lot easier. You know, people don't always say what you want. So not giving into that stuff takes a lot of self-discipline. I guess that's one of the big lessons.
I mean, those early newspapers, your description of them makes them sound like a microcosm of the media climate today. Yeah. But presumably, in many ways, the media climate today is evolved in some way. What's changed between now and then? How have we refined these techniques for capturing and harvesting attention?
Well some of the I'd say in about three ways. So some of the techniques are the same. The way I've described them, I think, you know, fake news still gets a lot of hits. In terms of advances in attention harvesting, there's been enormous change in the parts of our life where our attention is harvested. So you know, if we were talking 100, 200 years ago, you know, it was a newspaper and that, maybe that's it. Now, there's not a moment where someone's not trying to get your attention. You know, think from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed, how many appeals you get. You know, spend a second with me, click on this, take a look over here. You know, we're almost constantly buffeted. It is the liquid gold of our time, attention. And everyone's after it. And it's, you know, and it's in our houses, inside our friendship networks. You know, I think 30 years ago, people would think it's funny that your friends try and sell you stuff. I mean, they don't do it directly. But if you think about social media or something like Facebook, it's basically like you interact with your friends, but along the way, you hear about products. You know, that's become commercialized. So basically, most of the hours of our day have become commercialized. And I think that's a huge difference than, say, 200 years ago.
Stretching out from newspapers to all media is one way this attention economy has expanded. The other way is it's gone worldwide. You talk about it starting in New York newspapers, but now it's everywhere. How did that geographic spread happen?
Yeah, well, I would say Britain and the United States were hand in hand in developing these techniques. And
we're number one.
I mean, you look at what Britain contributes to the world right now, and it is an awful lot of celebrity storytelling, and there's just something about this island which has always managed to gain a lot more attention relative to its size. You know, I think these techniques have been copied and spread with the technologies they come with. You know, and it's difficult to say that, but you know, the spread of newspapers around the world through colonization is one technique. In the last, say, 20 years, it really has been the march of the American Silicon Valley giants that has brought these models. What's really interesting is that outside of China, Google, Facebook are everywhere and are usually the dominant companies everywhere. So it is a story almost of, you know, the march of Silicon Valley on the world that has spread the attention harvesting model in recent times.
Moving back in time, one turning point in your book that you describe is the professionalization of these techniques in propaganda in the two world wars.
Yeah. Again, this is a place where Britain plays a leading role. I don't know if most people understand that some of the first most effective propaganda techniques were invented on this island during World War I. And in fact, it was the success of British propaganda, as I talk about in the book, that inspired the Germans in World War II to say, we can do that. We can do better. In fact, Hitler in his cell, you know, when he was in prison in Bayern, was writing, you know, we lost the war because the British were so much better at propaganda than we were. I'm going to do better. Here's all the ways to do it. They did it all wrong. The Germans were too boring. We need to be less German and more British. That was what he was saying, which seems absolutely crazy. But one of the big themes of this book is that there's a back and forth between essentially powers of commerce and the powers of government in developing both propaganda and attention capture, which are very closely related. I mean, advertising used to be called propaganda until that word became a little distasteful. Britain pioneered techniques. Obviously, the Germans took things to an entirely different level during World War II. The Soviet Union, China, each of them essentially uses the same techniques, was they understood that they needed people to listen to either, you know, the pitchman or the great leader, whatever it was, and make sure that they, at least for some of the day, were playing rapt attention. And that is what the game is. That's the game we're playing today, still competition for attention.
Getting specific, what were the sort of techniques that Hitler wanted to copy? What did he view as a particularly effective form of attention capture?
So there were two things that Hitler really, I think, pioneered successfully. The first was he had these rallies where people in person would be so overcome with sort of rapturous experience of being in a crowd that it would almost convert them permanently to his cause. And so he sort of understood, and many of us have experienced that experience where you're in a crowd where everyone is thinking the same, where you kind of melt your identity and fundamentally get reshifted. And that doesn't happen that often. You have to be very, very deeply absorbed. You know, it doesn't happen, you know, when you're half-heartedly listening to a conversation or flipping through channels. It happens when you've probably in our own times, we have it most often maybe at a concert where you're like completely enraptured. And he harnessed that power and used it. But in terms of day-to-day capture, he was the most successful of understanding the power of radio and mass media. And in particular, he copied prime time. So he had this idea there should be periods where everyone in the entire country is listening to the same thing. And that will really change things. So they had these things called radio hours in Nazi Germany, where an army of what were called radio wardens would round up the entire population. They would sit together, and then they would listen to Hitler speak. And it was supposed to copy that experience of the rally. The entire nation of Germany listening to their leader at the same time and sort of feeling the rapture together would change how they were. Now, how is that a copy of a commercial technique? Well, it may sort of seem like a goofy comparison, But you know, at its height, let's say American television, you'd have the whole nation listening to I Love Lucy or watching I Love Lucy or something, or the Ed Sullivan Show, and you know, experiencing that together, forging the nation. And you had it with FDR speeches. You had it in Britain with Winston Churchill speeches. That is, I think, a very powerful technique.
One of the things you talk about in both this book and your previous book, The Master Switch, is a common trajectory that a lot of technologies like radio take, where they're invented by people with open utopian ideals about how they'll be used, and then eventually captured either by industry or politics and turned to the ends of attention harvesting. We saw it with radio, we see it with the internet. Yeah. It happens again and again. But how? What's the common thread between it?
Well, a lot of the most profound inventors are incredibly idealistic people. I think that's one of the reasons they're able to be inventors, is the people who are not that idealistic, you know, they go and make the mousetrap 10% better. And it's not easy to be these people. They only come, it only happens once every 20 or 30 years that someone does something completely world-changing. And the visions of it usually are that we're going to transcend whatever limitations we have as humanity. Sometimes it's religious. Some of the people who were invested in early radio thought it was the voice of God, and it's predictably these periods associated with the inventor, but also with the early enthusiasts, where media go through their idealistic phases. Radio in the 1920s, particularly both in Britain and the United States and other countries. The internet through the 1990s, early 2000s. It's going to transform us fundamentally, remove the shackles of old media and make us better. But it is never really too long until someone comes along and realizes that there is either the potential for power or profit. Sometimes it's actually the founder themselves starts to change what they think. We see over and over again, as you suggested, that the idealistic media become bent and shaped towards other ends. It takes a lot of self-discipline and institutionalization to resist, and usually fails, you know, to kind of capture that early idealism and make it last in some form, because the power or profit motives are so strong in these areas.
Along similar lines, another sort of cycle that you bring out is the theme that eventually people rebel against this attention capturing, right, and that it often backfires. It can end up strengthening the people in charge. For instance, in the 60s, the hippies rebelling against,
right,
against attention ended up, that decade ended with the attention economy stronger than ever.
Yeah.
How does this happen? How does that rebellion end up strengthening the attention economy?
Well, so the attention economy is driven by harvesting your mind. It is selling access to the brain. That's what is happening in any attention industry model. You know, the brain is a fairly intimate part of your body. It's amazing we allow it to be groped so often by strangers. And occasionally people have just had it. You know, whether it's maybe some of the listeners just like, these are too many ads, or this is just too commercial, or it's gotten too corrupted. And that will lead to, periodically, revolts. I think we're in a revolt right now, frankly, against advertising. The people have just had it. They happen almost about every 30 years, almost like on schedule. As you said, I think that's a predictable reason. And I think they are important. On the other hand, they can be co-opted, as you said. You know, they're not long-lasting. They're kind of these episodic moments, and everyone says, we got to do something better. And then it's almost as if we forget after a while and allow things to go back the way they were.
We'll come to the current rebellion in a bit, but yeah. First I want to talk about the cultural implications that the attention merchants have. You talk about how our society and our culture has changed by their success.
Yeah, so we live lives that are profoundly different than our ancestors, but one of the ways is our day-to-day existence is crowded by efforts to get our attention. Most of us don't go through a day without, you know, compulsively checking on one thing or another. At its worst, it can lead lives where we are constantly one way or another being subject to manipulation. Now is a time to be asking about the question of autonomy and free will, whether really living lives we want to be living. And I think that's a big implication. We're in new territory. There used to be vast parts of our lives which were non-commercial, private. You know, maybe we were bored more often in the old days. I'm trying to remember the last time I was actually bored. But, you know, it's usually when you're trapped with your phone doesn't work or something, mm-hmm, or whatever. We've conquered boredom, which is an achievement. But in exchange, ask whether we are you know, fundamentally more manipulated, where they're living lives that are ours. And there used to be huge areas of our lives, as I said, maybe it was the home or the social sphere, which were kind of beyond constant commercial influence. And I think that has dramatically shifted. And that is also moving towards political influence. I don't know if it's quite like this in Britain, but the United States, it seems like nothing is apolitical anymore. Everything is against or pro-Trump. Even any comment you make is either somehow an attack on Trump or against him. And that's power. You know, when everything is about the dear leader or the great leader, and whether you oppose or support him, it means he's in your life in this constant way. And I don't think that would be the way it is without our attentional economy.
When we come back, we'll speak to author Tim Wu about strategies to protect the internet from corporate control.
Hey Chips fans, this week's Guardian Books podcast tunes into the big hitters at this year's Hay Festival. Politician Shashi Tharoor talks about the inglorious history of British rule in India, and novelist Cory Doctorow imagines a world plunged into climate disaster. And we eavesdrop on Helen Fielding, winner of the Bollinger Everyman Woodhouse Prize for comic fiction, as she makes a surprising revelation.
Welcome back to Chips with Everything with me, Alex Hearn. I'm in the studio with law professor and author Tim Wu, talking about his new book, The Attention Merchants. Tim, what are we missing out on as a contemporary civilization when our attention is being so comprehensively captured?
That's a great question. So, you know, attention is a really, it's not only a powerful tool, it is the tool by which humans accomplish that which they would like to accomplish. So what I think we're missing out on is the power to do things that we want to do. Let's say you have in mind you would like to read more books, or maybe build models, or spend more time with your garden, or your grandchildren, or your children. One thing that's happening is a lot of these goals are falling prey to, oh, but then I spent 3 hours on Facebook by accident. You know, I wandered off and started clicking on, you know, random stories, or, you know, I think we may be losing the capacity to do what we want to do. I don't know about you. I often will go to my computer and I have this idea. I'm going to write one email. And I sit down and 2 hours go by and I was like, what just happened? And I think we're actually losing the capacity to do what we want to do in life. And I think that's an incredibly dangerous thing. I'll add to it that I think it is also hurting our ability to create things that require deep engagement. Many of the attention harvesting models want people sort of distracted, constantly clicking, moving, you know, going from side to side. It's taking us away from some of the more worthwhile experiences in life, some of which I've mentioned, which required a very deep, concentrated engagement. And I wonder if we're losing that ability.
To a certain extent, it sounds like you're sort of saying that attention merchants have, they've got all our attention, now they want our time as well. I mean, when did this switch happen? Is this something that's recent with the internet, or has this always been what the attention merchants want from us?
Yeah, time and attention are closely, closely linked. You know, Facebook's goal is time on site. Mm-hmm. Right? So it wants to maximize the amount of time you spend with them. That is the currency of our time. It's one of the last truly scarce resources. You know, a lot of other things are kind of flushing around in excess. Time is one of those last few scarce things. And it's not hard to see that in the future, that might be the only resource left is time, which is why I really urge listeners to seize it, understand how it's being spent, try to orient their lives that way.
So what solutions can you suggest? How can we rebel?
Yeah, I think I'll use two big answers. The first is I do really believe you have to structure your life in our time to remain sane. You almost have to program your own life. And you have to make hard decisions about what spaces you do not use your devices in. Like just, you know, total cutoffs. The thing that doesn't work is trying to say, okay, I will rely on my willpower to overcome the temptation. I'm going to try and write my novel, but on the other hand, I'll go into Facebook every once in a while and see what's going on. That is going to fail. It's sort of like the alcoholic who goes to the pub and says, you know, I'll just have one and everything will be fine. I'll control myself. That doesn't work. So you need to draw really hard physical lines. The second important thing is getting tools or being very selective about tools that serve you. I think that many of our tools, mainly our computers, have kind of turned on us a little bit. You know, I'm a writer. I would like my computer to help me write, but half the time my computer is helping me put money into Facebook. You know, it's a distraction machine. I sometimes say, you know, you can't imagine a chainsaw having a screen on it. That's counterproductive, but our computers, which are supposed to be productivity tools, half the time are working against us. I believe there's a new generation of tools being written. I'll mention this fellow, Tristan Harris, and his foundation, Time Well Spent, which is trying to urge technologists to build things that actually make you work better. And I think taking the time and effort to learn about tools that make you work better is really important. As I said again, I'm really impressed. You know, I have a lot of hobbies. And sometimes I'm really impressed with things like screwdrivers and hammers. They do what you say. Computers kind of do what you say and then try and sell you stuff along the way. Like, they're always taking you to the gift store. Investing in tools that do what you say is really important.
Along those lines, give us some hope. What successful examples of resistance to this model have there been on the net?
Yeah, I think there's been great examples. You know, your publishers may hate me saying this, but I think ad blockers are a sign of resistance. People are like, I've had it. I'm not going to live with this many ads. So they're sending a message. The rise of subscription-based stuff. I'll say this. We are past the era where you can be like, okay, everything's going to be free and there's going to be no consequences. That, you know, I kind of thought that when I was younger. It's done. If you want high quality stuff, you got to pay for it. I, you know, agree with The Guardian when The Guardian website says, if you really want to support this, you got to pay for it. And that is true. You know, the sophomoric era is over. What's optimistic is people are starting to pay for stuff. You know, television is going, especially where I live in the United States, is going through this boom where the most incredible shows are being made. There's money everywhere. It's because people are paying for stuff. I expect the same thing to begin happening in media. It's already happening to some extent. And, you know, these aren't huge amounts of money, actually, in order to have a healthy media ecosystem with really high quality stuff that wants to be on your side. It's not impossible. And I think we can transcend some of the mistakes we've made. I mean, as a species, humans learn. I think when we can recapture our attention, I think we can have a really great future now that we understand some of the danger. So believe it or not, I'm actually optimistic that we can come to spend our time, money, and attention wisely.
Picking on one particular example from the book that you say has structured itself well, you look at Wikipedia.
Yeah.
As one example. To a certain extent, that goes against a lot of the advice that you said. It, although it does a donation drive, it doesn't ask you to pay for its content, it doesn't run adverts. How can we learn from examples like Wikipedia?
No, Wikipedia is a good example. Mm. They do ask for money and they make you feel that you should support them. I do support them. I think three things you can listen. First of all, people will donate when something is worthy. When you're doing good ethical work that's valuable, people will support it. I think that's human nature. And Wikipedia, frankly, has more money than they know what to do with. Don't let that discourage you to give them, but they are doing well. No, I think it's important. I don't want to say they're like driving around in limousines or something. I'm just saying that they are making enough money to sustain the model, and that is really inspiring. And they've done that absolutely without any advertising, and that's very inspiring. So they haven't. I mean, advertising is really risky for an encyclopedia because, well, who's going to, you know, run ads against the article on genocide or something? You know, it's not going to work. And third, they have been really, really tough on basically fake news. You know, Wikipedia does not have a fake news problem. And in there lies a lesson for the rest of the media and even more importantly, rest of Silicon Valley. You know, Facebook and Google are like, oh, we can't get involved. We don't know what's fake or real. Wikipedia is another Silicon Valley, you know, tech company. It's like, listen, no more excuses. We're not going to let this stuff in. And so, you know, I won't say Wikipedia is perfect. They have articles on superheroes that are 10 times the length of, you know, famous, important historical figures. But they are sitting there. And I think they have a lot to be proud of, and there's a lot to be learned of. And they took the remedies early, and they stuck with them. Yeah, I think they show some of what's possible.
If you could get your book into the hands of the 50 most powerful people in the worldwide media industry, mm-hmm. what lessons would you hope they took from it? What impacts would you hope you could have?
I would hope that they would understand that they're in a sort of mutually destructive situation when they chase the lowest common denominator. You know, it's a short-term strategy that works to gain advantage, but in the long term, they're better off having their standards, which they do have, you know, not all journalists are at the bottom, but they've been pulled down, you know, to understand they are, and I think they do understand that they are and have been in the grip of a killer competition for attention, which has diminished them. Go towards paid sources of revenue as having more integrity as a way of making money. I mean, advertising is fine, but when you're only on advertising, it has this very warping effect when that's your only lifeblood. And ultimately, to understand that they are so responsible, so heavily involved in what the future of humanity is on a dated, on a moment-to-moment basis. And here I'm including Silicon Valley. I think Silicon Valley, in its early days, wanted to be different, wanted to be ethical, said that they were going to be different than old media. They need to understand how far they are from what they promised to be. They need to understand that their dedication of so much engineering talent to trying to fool people into clicking on things is not dignified, is frankly shameful. And if they want to recover the mantle of leadership, be looked up to again, if they want to be proud of their place in the world, they need to clean up their act. And that's what I think this book would teach them.
And that's all for this week's episode. Thanks so much to Tim Wu for coming on the show and for you for giving us your attention. The Attention Merchants is published by Atlantic Books. If you liked this show, you can subscribe to this and other great Guardian shows on iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. And don't forget to give us a rating or review. We really appreciate that as it helps more people learn about us. I'm Alex Hearn. Please join Leigh Alexander next week as she goes in depth on more issues from the world of digital society and culture. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.